This is Jay Thiemeyer for Hole in the Bucket. Welcome. Tonight we'll be talking with Lenore Beyond for the first part of the show about seniors and hunger, a largely invisible but incredibly important issue. I'd like to first note something from a recent survey in 2006 showed that Multnomah County is home to over 71,000 persons age 65 and over. 13% of this population lives below the federal poverty line. 22% of elders 65 and over with disability live below the federal poverty line. This line for a single-person household is $10,400 per year. According to the 2007 Oregon Senior Food Stamp Participation Report, over 40% of eligible Multnomah County seniors aged 60 and over received food stamp benefits. Compared to other Oregon counties, Multnomah has the highest percentage of eligible persons served. However, it also has the highest number of persons needing services. Multnomah County Aging and Disabilities Services staff note that seniors who live in assisted living or receive nursing home care, who receive congregate meals, are technically eligible for benefits but receive their food stamp allotment as part of the congregate meal program. Hunger for the elderly is an issue that affects all of us. Increasing expenses due to rising food costs, gas prices, utility costs, and medical bills put seniors in the precarious position of counting their nickels and dimes, often at the expense of healthy food and good nutrition. Economic inflation has the greatest impact on people living on fixed incomes. According to the Oregon Food Bank, 17% of households served in 2006 had at least one person who was 65 or older. This number will increase within the next 10 years as the boomer generation of current 45 to 59-year-olds retires. In addition, bankruptcy, consumer debt, and the nation's current mortgage lending crisis have also impacted this vulnerable population. AARP found that the number of people age 65 and older who filed for bankruptcy jumped 213% between 1992 and 2001, outpacing all other age groups. The debt level for households headed by someone 75 and older averaged $20,000 in 2004, a 160% increase from 92. The community faces various, very specific challenges. One, 13,568, about 60% of eligible persons age 60 or over are not receiving food stamps. The population of persons 60 or over is increasing as the baby boomers age. State and local governments, as well as several nonprofits, offer service and food programs for seniors, but the lack of information and transportation in particular are barriers, often limiting the numbers who actually receive the services. Multnomah County is the largest of all Oregon counties and will require greater commitment and creativity to increase senior hunger outreach. A growing number of persons that will be directly affected by the threat of poverty and hunger as they turn 65 and over. The community strengths are that food stamp participation for all age demographics in the county has dramatically increased since 2000 due to aggressive food stamp outreach by the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force. In fiscal year 2007, Loaves and Fishes Meals on Wheels program served over 12,000 people in the Portland metro area. Multnomah County has a large pool of committed and passionate volunteers working to eradicate hunger for the elderly. A number of local nonprofits work to provide outreach and food for seniors, such as Neighborhood House, Portland Impact, Human Solutions, Friendly House, Northwest Pilot Project, Elders in Action, Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force, the Multnomah County Department of County Human Services, the Oregon Food Bank, Lowe's and Fishes, Snowcap, and others. Tonight, we will be talking with Lenore Beyond, who is with Elders in Action. Lenore, are you on the phone?
Hello?
Hello, Lenore. This is Jay. How are you doing?
I'm fine.
Welcome to Hole in the Bucket.
Thank you.
Were you able to hear some of the information that I was reciting about the food stamp situation and hunger in the county?
Yes, I heard it very clearly. I don't want to knock food stamps, but there is a lot that I could say about that particular program.
Well, please do.
Well, one of the things is that I don't think a great many people are aware that those of us who are aging, I'm 77 and on a fixed income of $767, I believe, a month, so I'm below the federal poverty level, because I was a caretaker, as most people who are in my position, that's the case with most people in my position.
Mm-hmm.
My food stamps used to be, when I got $700 a month, total Social Security, they used to be 40-some dollars for one person for a month. Now that I'm getting the great, glorious income of $767 a month because of a cost-of-living adjustment, my food stamps have been decreased, as the price of food goes up, by the way,
right,
to $21 a month.
Well, that makes sense.
I'm sorry, but is there something wrong with my brain, or does it seem counterintuitive that the cost of living increase given low-income Social Security recipients should not be a cause for reducing food stamps?
Right. I know that before 1996, the food stamp allotment each year was augmented by a certain small percentage just to anticipate increases in food costs, and that was eliminated as part of Gingrich's contract on America, such that now
it's going in the opposite direction.
Right.
We're being, and not only that, but they're talking about the increased number. You mentioned the increased number of people who were actually applying for and receiving food stamps. The only reason that more people don't apply for and receive more of the percentage of people who are certainly eligible is because the actual food stamps that are allocated to each individual are so puny that they really don't make up for the costs that you have to incur taking a bus someplace where you can jump through all the hoops that you have to do to justify your eligibility for food stamps. And so if somebody's going to end up getting $10 a month in food stamps and they have to take a bus someplace and they have to take time out of their day, a great number of hours, it really isn't worth it.
Mm-hmm.
And what does even my $21 buy me? I figured out once that it would, if I was very lucky, buy me an apple a day.
I hope it's a big apple.
At the current cost of, well, if I found a terrific sale on apples, I might get an apple a day for that price.
I have some information on, it's titled The Governor's Food Stamp Challenge, Then and Now, and it compares the price of one small chicken in 2007 and 2008. In 2007, it would be $3.06. Today, it was priced at $5.34.
Yes.
As an example of the increase in food prices, that's a pretty good example.
Yes, and also things like nuts, mm-hmm, which are very compact and, by the way, are not included in the coupons that are given to people in the state of Oregon to encourage the buying of Oregon-grown produce. And here Oregon is one of the chief producers of nuts. And they are easily stored. They keep for a long time. It's by far the most, you get so few dollars. One person like me, I get $22, I believe it is, in those agricultural coupons. And to spend them on nuts would be the most intelligent thing one could do because they would last for a long time. They are great sort of concentrated pellets of energy, and it's really a pretty economical purchase. But we can't buy nuts with those things. We can buy lettuce and and apples as long as they're grown in Oregon, and other fruits, but we cannot buy nuts.
I know that used to be that food stamps could buy candy, sort of a testimony to the power of the sugar lobby, but you couldn't buy vitamins, which was kind of amazing to me. But there are these discrepancies.
Well, I think now they have that has been improved vastly, because one of the things that they have done for seniors, not for, I don't think it's for the general food stamp program, but for the senior program, they have given you a cash allowance rather than a targeted food allowance, so that you can't buy wine, for instance, but you can certainly buy very essential things like soap and toothpaste and things like that.
Right. Is there an age limit on that? Is that people over 60 or?
I believe so.
Right.
And I think that was a very intelligent thing to do, because it's important that older people eat. It's also important that they stay clean.
Right. Well, yes, and hygiene and self-image. Along with having to balance all the things that you have to balance on a low fixed income includes costs of heating and air conditioning, or heating especially.
Air conditioning, I can't imagine anybody who is as low income as I am. I mean, you conceivably would have fans, because you can get those.
Right.
But air conditioning, unless you've got a medical condition, I can't imagine anybody investing in.
Right. Well, they recently, I guess 2 days ago, the Senate failed to pass an increase in LEAP money, the low-income energy assistance program money, that was championed by Bernie Sanders. Hopefully that's going to be revisited. But with the increase in the cost of oil and heating oil and gas and all this, that just made sense. Have you been following that? And how does that impact you?
This is part of the perfect storm that is brewing. One of the things that, when you're discussing all of these growing threats to the well-being of people who are below the poverty line, one of the things that people fail to take into consideration, unless they work in the field as an advocate or in state offices, is the fact that we are in a triage mode already in the state human services, because money has been cut in the county and in the state, and basically streaming from the federal level, first of all, but then there's a chain reaction as it goes more and more local, so that all of the human services endeavors have had to tighten their belts, have had to cut programs, and now we are asking for basic programs to be reinstated, not to create new programs. And in the meantime, the population that is served is growing exponentially. And so already we're in this terrible situation. And then add to this this rise in prices in all sectors, and you really have a brewing disaster.
Right. Well, obviously healthcare is a big factor in all this. Can you tell me about the healthcare that you receive, and tell me about Part D especially? I know you get Medicare. How do you deal with Part D?
Well, the so-called, I think that was called the Medicare Modernization Act, which to me is, well, it depends on how you define modernization. I suppose it depends whether you're a neocon or not.
Mm-hmm.
But that act was the most horrible giveaway to the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies that ever came down the pike. And it just awes me that everybody could not see what was happening when that thing was passed. It's a disaster. It's of the sorts of increases in advantage for the insurance company. Before that was passed, I had some private insurance. I carried some private stopgap, or whatever it's called, Medicare gap insurance. And at that particular point, it was worth doing it because a hospitalization would have cost me nothing. And I wouldn't have had to pay anything on Medicare. Now, if I bought that same insurance, which I don't do, I'm straight Medicare now, which makes it difficult because it's hard to find a doctor that will take you when you're straight Medicare, but that's another problem. Now I find that the same company that I had was insured by changed its copays so that instead of paying $10 on an MRI, if you need one, you now pay 10% of the MRI. And instead of paying nothing for hospitalization, you are covered for, I think, the first 24 hours, and then you have to pay a percentage of your hospitalization. I mean, if you read all of the fine print, you see that the point of change that we passed with this Medicare modernization thing was that the insurance companies are making out big time. They have decreased the advantages to the paying customers. I can't afford to belong to one of these Medigap policy things anymore, and I don't. But I have to hold some Medigap policy, which I do with Humana for my pharmaceuticals, which really galls me. Because there again, it's a giveaway. Every month I get this huge 1 pound lot of papers in the mail that are my statement for the drugs that have been charged during the month, which happen to consist of two things with a grand total of something like $5. And for this, I have all this paper that it costs an enormous amount of time and money to produce that is my monthly statement from this insurance company. It just goes me because it is such horrible waste and such a giveaway when there are real people with real problems who are really at risk.
Well, the really upsetting thing is that the people in the Bush administration who sort of shepherded that Part D modernization bill, as it was called, are now lobbyists for the pharmaceuticals.
Well, of course. And they always were. They just didn't come out and admit it.
Right.
And they didn't get openly paid for it.
Right. And I got an interesting email recently that from Gordon Smith's office. He's the U.S. Senator from Oregon, that there's an aging conference or a conference on aging in Salem on August 14th, Thursday. It'll be an all-day conference. The event is free, but space is limited, so register soon. The conference sponsors are the good senator, AARP of Oregon, HealthNet, Lifelong Learning Institute at Chemeketa Community College, the ODS companies, Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, the Oregon Healthcare Association, Pfizer, Providence Health Plan, Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, which recently had the rate hike of about 20%, Salem Hospital, Salem Hospital Foundation, Santillan Memorial Hospital, West Valley Hospital, and Wyeth, the other pharmaceutical.
You haven't named one people. You've named most of the top players in the people who are violently against a single-payer system
exactly.
in this country.
Exactly.
And it's the pharmaceutical companies and the insurance companies that have the clout and the money behind them to keep us from getting what I think the vast majority of citizens in this country want and what is obviously the moral thing to do, and that's to have a single-payer health care system.
Agreed, agreed. I noticed one of the sponsors was ARP of Oregon. A great outfit that I've discovered is the Alliance of Retired Americans, and the Oregon chapter is strong. They're supporting single-payer, as I understand it. And I want to point out while we're talking about what we can do, that there is a forum that will be coming up in probably a month or so. I don't have the exact date yet, but we'll be talking about this on our next show, August 13th. There's a forum coming up on seniors and hunger. I hope you're looking forward to that and will participate in it, because I think the more people who know about this, especially what concerns me particularly about seniors, people on low fixed income, is that seniors are too often invisible to the rest of society, and society isn't generally aware of the of how seniors have to juggle all these different things, while the costs of these things are just soaring out of sight, it seems.
Well, I think one of the reasons for that is that I think most people are unaware of the psychological effect that all of these factors have on seniors. Low-income people tend to, for no particular reason, I mean, certainly not deservedly, but they seem to feel ashamed of being in this situation, or inadequate. Or I know that I felt this way. I felt when I haven't been able to meet all of my bills, I felt that maybe there was something that I could have done a little differently, or that I may have done wrong, or you tend to flagellate yourself mm-hmm. for being in this position. And it is really unfair that that you should do that to yourself, but that's the way most of the people of my generation were raised. That you take charge and you're responsible and you pay your bills on time and you have everything planned so that you don't get into this kind of an emergency.
Right.
Now is the time to give up this kind of false pride, and I've given it up,
mm-hmm.
and to start screaming to government and say, hey, we do exist, we're becoming more and more articulate, we're becoming more and more visible, and we're becoming more and more proactive, because we have to be and because we are worthy people. We do a tremendous amount. Seniors do an enormous amount to fuel, to be the human fuel for things like the SMART program at various grade schools around here, and to I've taught at some schools, and senior citizens do a lot of unpaid volunteer work that is really crucial to the society.
Well, that's what
deserves to be honored for that.
That's what Elders in Action is all about.
Right.
Right.
Elders in Action, we don't earn any money. It's all free volunteer work. We love our work because we're fighting for people. It kind of justifies the position that the experience that we've had. We're fighting for people who can't fight for themselves.
Right.
And it makes us feel wonderful. So it is very, very gladly given all those volunteer hours.
Well, conversely, you are more or less, you're doing well enough. You're self-sufficient. But if you had a major medical crisis, you would be totally thrown for a loop. We need to keep that in mind.
That is true. And I'm self-sufficient because I had the good fortune to buy a third of an acre 30 years ago, and I farm it.
Yeah.
That's why I'm self-sufficient.
Right. As long as your health holds.
As long as my health holds.
Right. And that
if my health doesn't hold, there is the prospects are very grim indeed.
Yeah, you would probably be warehoused in foster care.
I wouldn't be, because I would refuse to be. I would check out.
Right. I can understand that. I don't think you should feel ashamed. I want to read something here. This is from the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities in D.C. They came out with some wonderful stuff that aimed at issues impacting low-income folks. This is titled Average Income in 2006, Up $60,000 for the Top 1% of Households, Just $430 for the Bottom 90%. Income concentration at the highest level since 1928, new analysis shows. The shares of the nation's income flowing to the top 1% and top 0.1% of households were higher in 2006 than in any year since 1928, according to an analysis of newly released IRS data by economists. The average pre-tax incomes in 2006 jumped by about $60,000, 5.8%, for the top 1% of households, but just $430 or 1.4% to the bottom 90% after adjusting for inflation. They go on to describe that this is just more evidence about the movement of wealth to the top from the bottom.
Yes, we're becoming more and more a third world country.
Right. More and more uninsured, more and more impoverished.
Right.
And at the same time that the boomers are retiring and there's going to be more of a burden on the, or not a burden, but there's going to be more of a demand on the safety net, which has been really assaulted by the Bush administration.
Indeed it has.
Well,
it hasn't just been assaulted. It has been grabbed by the throat.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, again, talking about the LEAP, what's going on around the LEAP proposal, Bernie Sanders, of course, is the very progressive senator from Vermont. And what this legislation for low-income energy assistance would double the amount of money, given the increase in oil costs and so on, that and is so far it was defeated by the Senate, but it'll be coming back up again. We see that. How can there be any debate when the oil titans are being given everything? There are exponential profits, given first refusal on access and development of oil in the Middle East, particularly Iraq, and with the threat of a preemptive strike on Iran. How that could even be a prospect is beyond me. But that,
you know, Jay, that's a funny thing. I feel that there has been throughout the entire Bush administration, I have felt almost like I'm living in a schizophrenic world, because what the government tells us is the cause of various disasters is not what I seem to clearly see by the evidence is the cause of these various disasters.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a matter of who are you going to believe? Are you going to believe the people who are supposedly the experts, or are you going to believe what you see as evidence? And it's been, you know, ultimately you just begin not to believe the government at all in what they point out. I have listened to program after program when they say that the oil companies are not the cause of all of this increased cost of energy. And yet, on the other hand, the oil companies are making more millions of dollars every day than almost anybody than they ever have in their entire history. And I don't see that these two things jibe.
I have two images, one of Cindy Sheehan outside Crawford holding up basically the growing popular sentiment against the war, and these people driving past her in their bubble, in the black limousines, just totally able to totally ignore.
Or their Humvees.
Right. Well, people just, you know, talking to themselves. They don't know the popular reality in this country.
It's a let them eat cake
that's
society.
Exactly it. And the other image is when, at the beginning of the Bush administration, when Cheney was heading up this energy policy group, when Ken Lay had free run of the White House, the head of Enron, his criminal and unscrupulous personality.
Kenny Boy.
Yes, Kenny Boy, right. The oil titans, the energy people, were determining policy, and not the people. And the people are paying for it, even though Ken Lay is gone and these other people, Fasto, are doing time or they're out of the picture. This is criminal, and hopefully I really hope that we'll see some change soon.
Well, also, one thing that I think is very much in keeping with your subject on this program is the very, very horrible transcripts of telephone calls at the time of the Enron thing, where they were various traders were talking about how they had really buffaloed these old people out of a tremendous amount of money.
It is. It's just unscrupulous and immoral. It's impossible to imagine that these people can live with themselves, and yet they can. And that's what power and hubris are all about, I guess.
Yeah.
Lenore Beyond with Elders in Action, talking about seniors and hunger. I want to thank you very much. This has been another wonderful conversation with you. Thank you.
Well, I'm delighted to do it anytime. I have lots of opinions, as you well know.
Yeah, I appreciate it. We could talk about a lot of different things, I'm sure. I'll see you soon at Elders in Action.
Okay, great.
Great. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
We are now going to take a break, and when we come back, we hope to talk with Nabi Mustafa, who is with the on the staff at the Garlington Community Center, which, of course, has been recently under the gun as a result of the Cascadia Behavioral Healthcare implosion. They have been given – Garlington has been given a reprieve. I want to find out from Nabi how his program, which is treatment, not punishment, treatment as an alternative, in other words, to incarceration, what's the status of that program and his job and Garlington, which was revealed at a hearing I went to about the impact of the Cascadia problems on Garlington. It was revealed that this is an incredibly vital, valuable community center, and we hope it survives. We'll be back momentarily.
Put a candle in the window. Cause I feel I've got to move. Though I'm going, I'll be coming home soon. Long as I can see the light. Pack my bags and let's get moving. Cause I'm bound to drift a while. Though I'm gone, you don't have to worry about me. No, long as I can see the light. Guess I've got that old traveling bone. But I feel I'm leaving alone. But I won't be losing my way. No, as long as I can see the light. Won't you play that thing for me right now? Candle in the window. Ooh. Cause I fear I've gotta move. Cause I'm going, I'll be coming home soon. Long as I can see the light. Long as I can see the light. Long as I can see the light.
Ooh. Welcome back. That was Ted Hawkins singing As Long as I Can See the Light, the John Fogerty tune. Ted Hawkins was a homeless man in Venice Beach, and he was discovered. He's produced a number of CDs. He's a wonderful singer. Sounds a lot. You can hear the influence of Sam Cooke, Otis Redding. He's just terrific. We're now talking with Nabi Mustafa, who is with the Treatment Not Punishment program at Garlington Community Center. which, as I mentioned, was recently given a reprieve, and that apparently appears to be stable. And so we'll be getting an update on Garlington and the program. Welcome to Hole in the Bucket, Nabi.
Hi, Jay. Glad you have me on the show.
Yeah, it's good to see you again under better circumstances.
Yeah.
Can you give us an update about Garlington?
The information I have, and it appears to be information that's available to the public, is that Garlington was initially put on the list for the downsizing of Cascadia, and it was one of the sites that was chosen. And with the input from the clients and input from the community and input from several different sources, including Ava Gorley, the state senator, they've reversed that decision. In fact, the information came out, the decision was not really well thought out in the first place, because they didn't have a criteria to select the sites that were going to be closed or the programs that actually were going to be shut down. And what came about was that there's reasons that Garlington was there in the first place. And one is that people in the community needed the service. There are services that the Garlington Center and Cascadia, in fact, are providing that are not provided by other providers, that somebody wants to check into it, they can say without me having to go into all the names of those different sources. But apparently there were people that thought that these services could be provided by other entities besides Cascadia in the community, and they found that that was probably not the case. So they rethought that, and Garlington is secure now. It's going to be there. In fact, they're working, trying to make it a viable site. In other words, provide more services so that it will at least be able to cover the expenses of the mortgage and probably, salaries and whatever else it needs to be a viable site. So that's what's going on. And it seems like it's heading in that direction now.
A lot of people aren't aware of how severe the implosion of Cascadia Behavioral Health Care and how significant that is for so many people. They're the biggest mental health care provider in the state. There are a lot of people, especially locally, who are provided services. Garlington Community Center provided services and served as a community focus for a lot of people.
Yes. And part of the change, actually, it hasn't just started, but part of the change is they used to have a drop-in center when they were located on Killingsworth and Albina, and that was one of the ways that you could kind of reach out and get, clients could be more easily found. They were involved in lots. So that drop-in center went away, and so there were a lot of clients that kind of got lost in the shuffle then. And then they move, which is actually a much better site. The move was not a bad thing, moving from Albina and Killingsworth down to MLK, because there was a lot more parking. It was a newer, much newer building. Everything was on one level. And it actually could accommodate more services within that structure. So it was actually a pretty good move. But, like I said, one of the things, there's several good reasons for that site to remain open. One, there was a commitment initially when it was opened that there would be a Garlington Center. And that Garlington Center was named after some people in the community, John Garlington and his wife, who died in a car accident some years back. So the Garlington name is very important, significant in the community.
Could you tell us some more about the Garlingtons? I know they were mentioned at the hearing, but
John Garlington was a pastor, and he was a pastor over at Maranatha Church. And him and his wife, they went on a vacation, and I think it was in Florida that they got into a car accident. They were both killed. But he did a lot in the community. He was a very active pastor, and he did a lot of community service. So initially that Garlington name was connected to a center that was on Alberta and MLK, and it provided mental health services. And it was actually a pretty good tribute. His son is actually came when they opened this new site, and it was part of the dedication of that service. So they did a lot of volunteerism and stuff in the community that people recognized. And there was a commitment to maintain, that legacy with the Garlington Center.
Yeah, that sense of sympathy and caring and all
yes.
that. Yeah, I know that... I've been to two hearings around what's happening with Cascadia. One was at Benson High School, and only one client showed up. All the rest were providers, county people, and sympathetic advocates and whatnot. But the meeting at Garlington was packed with people who were clients, who were immediately impacted. They were members of the community. It was obvious at that meeting to me that how much the Garlington Community Center meant to the whole community. And it was pretty powerful, and I think it came across to
right.
The people.
Right, and I think, too, part of the attitude that people brought was that, you know, they felt like the change was so significant, I mean, and so impactful, potentially, that they should have been informed. And in fact, there were people who were saying, well, why weren't people involved at other stages of this, which there wasn't really. A lot of it was done behind closed doors. So they were a little irate that something so significant was not made, they were not made aware of. So there was an effort on many people's part, including my own, to make sure that they were aware this was going to be going on, mm-hmm. and we needed to speak up. And surprisingly to some, not necessarily to me, but the clients had a very, very powerful voice. I mean, because someone has a mental disorder, a mental illness, a personality disorder, or whatever, does not mean that they don't know what's in their own best interest, you know. And they spoke very eloquently to some people's shock, you know, about how significant it was to have those services there. They related some of the experiences they've had and with other providers and within Cascadia also at other sites.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, what was conveyed to me was that there were a lot of things that individuals were talking about that the people at large, normies, would not be aware of, like the importance of having a place that was convenient.
Yes.
That, you know, travel is a real problem for some people who are dealing with various issues.
Yes.
And having that community, people you can trust, like yourself, you
yes.
know, that this is critical. And to go through that as big a change as looked like was going to happen,
yes.
would be a huge trauma, really, for
yeah.
some of those.
And in that community, along with trust, they go hand in hand. Is that relationship building? That's very important. And a lot of times, with the what we call it, assembly line approach, it doesn't work with people in that have a mental disorder. And like also too, even traveling on the bus is a real ordeal for some people.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? If they can go to a place that they can walk to, is it within a 5, maybe 10 block radius?
Right.
Or even if they have to ride the bus, but they don't have to ride that far.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot. It makes a lot of difference.
Right. If people who haven't experienced this, I know that I have friends who, you know, traveling on a bus would mean a panic attack of major proportions.
Yes.
And this is like not, you know, having trouble breathing, feeling like everything was closing in, and
yes.
just really, that's, unless you're dealing with it, it's hard to convey.
And too, you have a very, very good staff at Garlington Center. They go to great lengths to make people feel welcome, you know, the atmosphere there. And there were numerous comments about how they were treated and how they appreciate how they were treated at Garlington Center.
Yeah, good point. I was not real clear, you brought this out at that hearing, whether the staff at Garlington was in jeopardy, or whether the whole treatment not punishment program was in jeopardy.
Treatment not punishment.
And could you describe
it? Yeah, it's a program. Actually, it was funded initially for 2 years. It lasted beyond that. It was pretty successful, actually, and it actually the grant expired a while back. I mean, it's been over a year, but Cascadia had committed it to carry it on at least month by month for a while, and then in January of this year they just said, okay, well, we're going to make sure that this program is at least lasts through June, and because there are a lot of June is the you know, it's like a lot of programs get refunded in July. It's the, what do they call it?
The new budget, right?
Yes.
The fiscal year.
Fiscal year.
Cycle.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the end of the fiscal year. So I do have a statistic to show that what they were initially created, treatment not punishment, to do, they were very successful in that. And I was hired a couple of years back, not hired out from another entity. I was already working at Cascadia at a men's treatment center called the Residential Integrated Treatment Services. at Ritz, for short. Yeah. And they asked me to come over there and to work. And initially that program was put together by people from the county, a psychologist named Jackie Strong. And it was focused on the people who seemed to be repeat going to jail, the people who were downtown, who they were suspected or had documented mental disorders, people who were using a lot of the ambulance services, which are very expensive, the emergency rooms, the psychiatric wards. And we were given a list of 30 individuals, African-Americans who... this was a culturally specific program initially, and I think now it's being expanded to include the Latino community. But the idea was that people thought if they were treated in a certain way and they and addressed the cultural issues, that we could have a positive impact, and that ended up being true. Mm-hmm. There were people who were going to jail on a regular basis or the hospital or the psych ward, and we were able to get them housing, get them treatment, get them doctors, find the right medication in some instances, and care about them, which is very important, too. And build up trust. Relationship building was a big part of the Treatment Not Punishment program. So it was pretty successful. However, I think that one of the things that happened as a fallout of the issue with Cascadia is that they wanted to reduce Cascadia. And there was really no one advocating for treatment, not punishment. So it just fell by the wayside. It was just one of those things. Since it didn't have to be refunded, it was not.
Did you work with, or do you work with corrections to get people who are going through the revolving door because of mental health problems into the jails and out and back?
And yes, we did. We worked with the POs. We worked closely with some of the POs. We would like to work closely with others of the POs, but some of them, well, they have what they call mental health POs, and they are familiar with the mental disorders. And if someone that was involved in the correctional system had a documented mental disorder, there's a good chance that they would be assigned to a mental health PO. And they were a little more understanding about some of the issues that their clients had to face. And so we worked closely with some of them. We knew that a lot of them, one of the main problems contributing to them being in custody or going to jail or whatever, or not being able to follow their parole restrictions, was their mental disorder. So, yes, we worked with the corrections. A lot of our referrals came from the corrections system.
Right. So what exactly is the status of treatment, not punishment now?
Well, right now, it ended on the June 30th. And I'm not sure if it's going to be taken up, because one of the things that happened, Central City Concern got a contract, and it's supposed to serve the Latino population and the African American community, but they don't have the program up and running quite yet, and I'm not sure it's not going to be providing the same services or the same level of services.
Wow.
So actually, the treatment not punishment is gone at this point.
Are you still with Garlington?
No, I'm not with Garlington. I was working with Treatment Not Punishment. Right now, I'm looking, because I've been at Cascadia for 7 years. So what I'm trying to do is get back into. I may end up at the residential treatment center or some other facility. It may not be Garlington. I'm not particular about working downtown, but at this point, I'm just waiting for them to find a spot for me at Garlington or at Cascadia, actually.
Ritz, I thought had some cut in their funding. What is their status now?
Well, I doubt that. The Ritz is pretty stable because it's a vital service, and actually all of their referrals are from the corrections.
Mm-hmm. Now, these are former.
And they have a waiting list actually for the Ritz. Okay. So that they're not in any. In fact, the housing component and the Ritz is not the part of the housing, but those are two components that are not going to be reduced to Cascadia. That's the housing and the residential treatment.
Right, and the residential treatment was basically sort of a transitional kind of situation for getting people who had mental health problems and addiction problems who were moving from the jails and the corrections to help them get housing. There was sort of supportive housing, and is that was
well,
that the thing?
Well, it's not. It wouldn't be considered transitional. Actually, it's treatment, and it's necessary that once.
Well, I meant the housing part.
Yeah. If you go through housing, they try to get you into permanent housing once you're mentally stable and once you went through treatment. And what they found is that if a person has a drug and alcohol problem and a mental health problem, if you don't treat both of those, then you're probably going to end up having to see that person again. You know, the chances of them being successful are greatly minimized unless you treat them for all the issues that they have.
Right. The surveys that that I've looked at show without question that these programs of diverting people who are otherwise going through the revolving door or they're, you know, from the jails out on the street back to jail and so on, that these programs that interrupt that cycle and help people with housing and treatment and so on produce a huge benefit to society. They lower the cost of, you know, obviously of incarceration and victimization.
It's well documented. Treatment may cost you, $50-$100 a day, whereas when you talk about jail beds or a psychiatric ward or hospitals
or an emergency room,
yeah, you're talking $500-$600 a day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so overall, the treatment is from a fiscal standpoint, it just makes sense to keep funding treatment, and from a humanistic point of view, it works. You know, people have been able to live good lives after having received treatment, and it's been successful. So yeah, that part of is going to continue. In fact, they're getting more information every day about how best to provide treatment for individuals who need it.
So the treatment, not punishment program that you were part of has ended, but it's being sort of retooled and set up.
Well, no, they did award a grant to Central City. Well, it was, you know, and it provides, the idea is to keep people from that revolving cycle of jail. And now I'm not sure, I can't really say how this program will work because it will not provide the same level of services that treatment, not punishment. In fact, we did a lot of outreach. We made sure people, and not just move them into housing, but that if they needed inpatient treatment, that's what we recommended for them. But we walked people through people who had never had their own homes. You know, it's called intensive case management. They won't be providing intensive case management.
Oh, wow.
We would see them at a minimum of 3 times a week.
Mm-hmm. That sounds to me like it's bound to fail.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what they ultimately will do as far as gearing up for the kind of clientele that we serve.
Mm-hmm.
But as it stands right now, this level of services is quite reduced.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first part of the show, we were talking about seniors and hunger, and we were talking about the Bush administration, and things ended on a very, very dismal note, and I was hoping that you would help us climb out of that. We were doing treatment, not punishment, and alternatives to incarceration, but it sounds like everything's in jeopardy. So given this campaign season, we need to let the candidates know what's needed and that they need to fund legislation to support it.
Yeah.
I know that you're also right, and I'd like to – can you talk about the event coming up?
What I'm doing now is every Wednesday evening, and when I leave here, that's where I'm headed – we're doing Portrait Miracles Club. Miracles Club is a social club, and it's a non-alcohol, non-drug social club that is in the community. It's it has as much significance or more than the Garlington Center, actually.
Part of a piece, aren't they?
Yeah. It is. It's been in the community now for 15 years, I believe, since 1992. It's moved a couple times. It initially started out on Killingsworth. Just off Albina Street on Killingsworth, and we moved one time to MLK near Bryant, MLK and Bryant. We were there probably less than a year, and then we moved into the current location on MLK and Mason.
Mm-hmm.
And right now we've gotten the donated from Portland Development Commission a lot across the street where they'll be building a facility from the ground up. So they provide a place for people who are in recovery to go to socialize. They have NA and AA meetings. They've had fashion shows, dances. I do poetry there. We've had actually a pretty large gathering of providers, and a lot of networking goes on there. But they had recently a recovery summit at Miracles Club, and it was very, very successful. A lot of people did some networking there, people from the federal government, from the state government, from county, from city came and made people aware of different funding options that they had. So it was Hollywood Henderson came and he gave a talk, and I don't know how much people know about him, but he has had his bouts with drugs, and he's been, you know, on the good foot for here 20 years or so. But he had a very fascinating story to tell. So when he came as part of that presentation.
Right. We're closing in on this. It's only got a couple of minutes left. I want to say it sounded like PDC got one right for a change. And I think that's great that Miracles has a stable footing. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
I would like for you to read something, if you would.
Okay. I have some poetry with me because I'm on the way there. Right. And I'll just maybe do a couple, a little short.
Okay. This is Nabi Mustafa.
Okay.
Reading his poetry.
And I'll do this one. It's called Today. And goes like this. Today I start my life again. Today I have one more chance. My slate is wiped clean and I can begin to take charge of my life's circumstance. I'll not forget about yesterday and pretend that mistakes didn't happen, but I will keep my focus on living today and live the best that I can. I will not make new enemies and I'll try to make new friends. The world is a place of opportunity and this day my new life begins. Every day is a new day, the day we said was tomorrow. Yesterday has faded away except for the experience we borrow. I will borrow from my bank of experience and boldly step out in the world, keeping in mind I have one more chance to capture that elusive pearl. I will keep my mind in a positive mode and give thanks for all today's blessings. I will determine what the future holds, accepting those things I can't change. So today I take all the responsibility for being just where I'm at, for living my life and dreaming my dreams. I'm blessed indeed, and I'll remember that.
Thank you very much. I think that concludes it. We've been talking with Lenore Beyond about Seniors in Hunger and Nabi Mustafa about treatment, not punishment, and the reprieve that Garlington Community Center got, and the poetry on Wednesday nights at the Miracle Club at MLK and Mason at 7 o'clock.
7:30 to 9:30 every Wednesday.
7:30 to 9:30 every Wednesday. This has been Hole in the Bucket with Jay Thiemeyer. And guests, thank you very much. And I want to thank Sean Ongley, our engineer. And tune in on August 13th for our next show, 6 o'clock. Thank you. Jesus Christ.